2022 is going to be so easy compared to the past. And then we had more spikes, all the shipping issues, and then we had Ukraine war, and now, of course, Roe v. Wade, and so just like, and inflation. And so like all of this stuff just piled on, and I was like, oh, it's gotten harder.
Ethical sourcing, sustainability, radical transparency, and helping people live their best lives with the least impact on the planet. My guest on today's show is the man behind it all at Everlane, Michael Praisman, who recently parted ways with his founder and CEO title, shifting to founder and climate lead at Everlane. We talk about that here on the episode. I got to tell you, some episodes just fly by. This was one of them. Enjoy. So I heard a rumor that you actually wanted to be a graphic designer when you grew up. Is this, like, let's just start right there, Michael. Is this the case? And are you disappointed now that you didn't get your first choice?
Oh, man. You know, I when I was a kid, I really had a few different stints, to be fair. There was a point in time which my parents called me Martha Stewart because I would garden all the time and redo our whole garden. I was doing a ton of graphic design for the school newspaper. I had a year where I was like only cooking pastries in our kitchen. And so like I had a lot of these sort of creative, I guess you could say, pursuits. And I think so. There's like a part of me that wishes I got to, because it's, I really believe that what you gravitate towards as a kid is in some shape or form, your coherence and what you should spend your life doing in a sense. Everlane is actually, there's ways to tie that in that one can explain where these all intersect. But I heard this story about, you know, a violinist who at the age of 4 was taking rubber bands and putting them across knobs of drawers and playing them as a kid. And then he ended up being a world-class violinist. And so like, yeah, maybe I should have just been a chef.
chef,
graphic designer, you know, basically I should have opened up a restaurant and done the design for it. That's what I should have done.
Well, look, I mean, we might need more time already because I am totally a believer that we're all little boys and girls trapped in these adult bodies trying to like make the most of our lives. And I'm personally the second of two. My brother is 4.5 years older, and we wonder why I'm an observationalist for a living. As I like watched where he got in trouble, I'm like, oh, they'll do that. And here we are today, you know, where I see myself as a compensated observationalist. So, I mean,
100%.
You also, by the way, I mean, with the new title, couldn't you? Right. So maybe I should go back. So like, Michael, you're now not just founder and CEO, you're founder and executive chairman, correct?
Yeah. I'm founder, exec chair, and climate lead. So I sort of think about it as I had 4 jobs before. And I think when you start a company, you don't realize this. You're the founder, you're the head of the board, you're the CEO, and usually the largest shareholder. And in some sense, I only gave up one title, like the CEO title, right? And I think if I had been a little bit more thoughtful about that back in the day, I would have been able to approach the job in a much more productive way rather than sort of a point and shoot or shoot and point, whichever came easier at the time.
Well, I can't imagine you have free time still, but that's probably by choice.
Well, actually, I would say I have taken by choice more free time than I normally would have. I'll tell you, because I like to be just totally transparent. I was not the CEO. We hired a CEO. I hired a CEO, Andrea. She's amazing. You can talk more about that. And all of a sudden you look at life and I see so many people that jump from job to job. And I was like, I don't want to do this. And I've just done something for 10 years and I don't even know whether that was fully the right thing. In fact, right, I should have been a chef and done the graphic design for the restaurant. And so I actually first jumped in and started doing investing and started doing a bunch of like helping other people. And then I looked at my schedule and I was like, wait, what am I doing? This is not what fills my bucket. And so I've actually pulled back on a lot of things and then going to on this trip with my over the past 3 weeks gave me the opportunity also to just pull out a lot of things and reset. So I really am trying to spend the time to think about what is the next 20 to 30 years going to look like for me.
Was there a new restaurant in that conversation?
There's a buddy of mine who does want to do a restaurant. So there might be. It's more, I really am thinking about, and we're going into a new territory here of how to think about life as a practice. I think you have a practice by doing what you're doing. Architects have a practice. Artists have a practice. But the notion of working for a company is not a practice. You sort of work at a company, do a job, and then you switch your job 3 years later and do another job, and you're constantly moving this ladder. And you could say life is a practice, but I really want to find a way to turn my work into a practice day in and day out.
Yeah, I'm definitely right there with you. And it's almost disappointing. Remember when we had commutes? I don't know if people are doing commutes anymore because of the way the world is. But like, there's this fictitious line for people on the way to commutes where they go from who they really are to work version of themselves.
Yep.
And maybe it doesn't exist when you have radical transparency as sort of like, hey, let's honor being real at all times. But yep. In most companies, that's not the case. And then they find out that they're kind of miserable not being themselves at work. Do you see that as a truth as well?
For me, I definitely do. And there was a point in time where also, you know, you can think of the role as starting a company. You're the founder. You're then the founder CEO. Then you're the CEO founder. And all of a sudden, the CEO has to come first. And that's when it becomes a job. And I definitely saw that happen for me. And especially also working from home, the mix, it's like a lot of stress. And for our team, honestly, yes, we have radical transparency. But I think part of the challenge is that just work in and of itself is this concept of working for a corporation. And I think it's a necessity of society today, but it's foreign and we have to figure out how to make it work in this new environment. You know, if you go back 100 years, everybody just worked for their family business. It wasn't so normal to work for a big company. And so I don't know that we've totally figured out how to make that work for people in today's society. And I think especially in hybrid, it's harder than ever because everything's just bleeding together.
Can we memory lane for a hot second?
Yeah.
All right. So like, let's go back to the beginning of all this for you. Like, cause I feel like you were like the OG direct to consumer brand before
totally.
It was called DTC and that became a thing. Right. So like when you go back to the beginning, I mean, just to hear it from you, like why so much conviction for this? You were an investor also, I think. So did you raise money or did you bootstrap it? What were those first years like?
The easy way to look at most things, I think, for me is I often look at someone who's successful and I go, oh, that was easy. And then, of course, like the path to get there was really quite challenging. You know, I left, I worked in investing for 3 years, the opposite of being a graphic designer, because that's what I felt I was supposed to do. And it was, like you said, kind of miserable because I think so much of the hardship is, are you doing what you love and can you be yourself? And I could be myself. I just wasn't doing what I loved. And I left, and actually for a year, before we raised money, we kicked around the tire on three different ideas. I didn't want to commit because I was like, oh, we should try this. Oh, we should try this. Oh, we should try this. They were all tech focused ideas like curation, similar to Pinterest, or we did like a QVC mobile version thing that was, we were playing around with. And then finally we realized a year in, we got to commit. Like you can't just keep going partially into ideas. And so we had actually raised money on the tech idea. And I remember this moment where we decided we're not going to be tech. We're going to be a brand because the markups are so high. And now what do I do? Like, do I tell my investors? What do I say? And that moment was really quite, I remember literally sitting and waiting and sending this email and just being like, click, oh gosh, what are people going to say? And I get back maybe of the investors, a quarter respond and they go, great, good luck. Let me know how I can help. And I was like, whoa, the narrative I told myself of what I thought was going to happen and how scary it was nowhere near as scary as the reality.
And the amount of time you probably wasted, not wasted, but thought about.
No, totally, right. Totally wasted. I mean, it's like I totally convinced myself that this pivot was, it's not what they invested in. But in fact, what they invested in was the market and the founder, you know. And so how we approached that market just changed, but that was fine with them.
So when did radical transparency obviously that's a show example versus a tell, but what's great about those two words, it's so clear. So like, when did that show up in all of this?
So organically, like nowadays, I think I would be more intentional. It started with, we launched this t-shirt. The original tagline was, your $120 shirt sells for 8 times what it costs to make, not at Everlane. Then we launched a t-shirt for $15. And we were like, how do we tell people the value of this product? Oh, we should just be transparent about our pricing. Let's go. So we were transparent about the pricing. All of a sudden that went viral. And we're like, wow, there's something here. And so we started uncovering the truths of the industry and telling that story as we built it, whether it was how the markups work, how sales work, how finding factories work. And we started telling the story. And then we just were like, hey, this isn't just transparent. This is radically transparent. So we started saying that internally. And then one day we just, it literally just started showing up in our copy. And then over a period of, I tend to say repetition is reputation. Over a period of 2 to 3 years, it became the reputation, and that was it, you know? And so like, call it 3-4 years in, that was our tagline everywhere.
I by the way, repetition is reputation is solid. That is good. I'm a broken record that you even make believers or fake believers.
Yeah.
Fake believers don't wear a t-shirt around the office that says fake believers. They just nod and smile. And the way to make a believer is repeating yourself and assuming it's the right thing for you, you're in. And so you think this was like a year in, 3 months in?
The transparency itself to say, let's be transparent about our pricing was two, 3 months in. And I remember, yes, actually this past weekend I was hanging out. Do you remember the brand Splendid LMOS?
No.
It's a t-shirt brand that got quite big in its time in the late 90s or early 2000s. And I was happened to be hanging out with the guy who started it. And he's like, I remember when you started sharing your pricing everywhere. And I just thought, what a piece of, and, you know, he's like, you mother effer. And he was like, and then he gave me a props because it was like such a radical idea to just say, this is what it costs to make. Nobody was doing that. And still nobody does that because they don't want you to know what the markups are that you're paying.
So I'm curious, and if there was like a pie chart for your mind, just here, because you're like an investor, you wanted to be a graphic designer. Oh, yeah. Like where are you living? Are you left brain? Are you right brain? What are the percentages if you had to put percentages to both?
That's such a great question. So we're going to be very honest here. My mom once said to me, there's no space for the heart making decisions. The head should make all the decisions. Mm-hmm. I think, and that was like a little sad for me. And I think my intuition is really strong. And then my fear of failure often takes over and the left brain kicks in. And so it starts to say, okay, your intuition says this, but is that real? What are the processes? And so if you look at like a Myers-Briggs, that intuition or judge, it's intuition or thinking, like from the heart, my intuition is really strong, but then the thinking just like in the whole judgment takes over because I'm like, what if I fail?
Yeah. You know, look, I got a chance to spend a couple of years talking to people about fear. And one of my favorite conversations is like, fear was with Loretta Hidalgo, who is an astronaut at Virgin Galactic. And she's like, fear is not trying to hurt you. It's just a data point. And if anything, you should be like, thank you, fear, for being here to keep me on my straight and narrow. Keep us going down the right path.
Without a doubt. Fear, I mean, that saying, the only thing to fear is fear itself is like so true, right? Because if you could undo fear, I mean, yeah, you'll definitely get in some shit. But you look at the guy, well, I forgot what his name is, Daniel, who climbed El Capitan front facing without any, I mean, he just doesn't have that trigger. Like he doesn't have anxiety. And look at what he had to accomplish. There's just no way anyone else can do it because even if they're physically able and technically able, fear will get in the way.
Yeah. So I've done, I think 80 of these shows now, which is crazy. And it's just, it's almost.
Congratulations.
Oh, thanks. No, but it's cool. Like, you know, if I would love to take you to lunch. And so this is my way of taking you to a digital lunch here and ask you.
I should have. It's, you know, it's 12:30. It's 12:15. I should have brought my lunch.
Oh, you can still do it. We could pause the show. So it's almost sad though that, and I always say that telling the truth is now an act of courage. I mean, you would put it in the words of being radically transparent is an act of courage.
Yeah.
How did this happen?
You know, that's that's a bit of my DNA. It's funny when you were talking about this whole fear thing, I was thinking about this book I read over my break in the past 3 weeks called Creative Visualizations. Do you know this book?
No.
Great book given to me by a board member of ours, Natalie. And it's all about how to sort of use visualizations to manifest your reality, because if you sit there and you start to think about the scenarios of success, it starts to remove the fear. And it's a, call it a 150-page guidebook to how to unblock a lot of this anxiety and fear and to live from a place of the heart versus the mind. Very, very cool book. I highly recommend it. It's built on a lot of the principles that this group, the Hoffman Group, uses as well. I would say when I am at my best, and often I'm at my best when I'm not surrounded by too many people, so I have clarity of thinking and just space, and I don't have societal sort of like views or that inside voice, I can think very clearly and work from that heart and say, hey, what do I think is the right thing to do? And in this case, to me, the right thing to do was, let's just be honest about our pricing at that time and place. And so if I can sit in that quietness long enough, the conviction builds, and then it's like a straight and narrow go. So that's how that came about. And that's just been me my whole life. Like the just conviction and clarity when I get time to settle into, like, the dust settles, the sky's clear, and go.
Do you have to go to Italy for 3 weeks to make that?
Like, no, the best clarity? Actually, I know where the friend once told me is, they're like, know where your ideas come from. My ideas come from hiking by myself, usually for a couple of days in like mountains.
And do you let your brain, are you like, okay, I know this is like, let me just go out there and let me not overthink it. Let me just be in nature and good things will come of it.
Yeah, or totally.
Okay.
Totally. Do you have a spot like that? Or practice?
I acknowledge that, and I can't explain why. Maybe it's in the book. I'm always like, when I'm on something and I go away from something and I come back to it, and I just think it's like the nature of life. For some reason, whenever I come back to it, I'm ready to go. And I'm like,
yeah,
oh my
totally.
Goodness, why didn't I see that? Or now we can like double up on this courageous idea. And I get so much energy from courageous ideas. Like that's my happy place. But I'm not like, I must go on a hike. Although I'll tell you what, recently I've been doing a lot more. I got the Peloton in the house. I've got I'm sharing more than in the spirit of radical transparency. I've got like one of these new saunas in the garage.
Oh, cool. Like an infrared one or something.
Yeah. And like, it's kind of where I would say others would say it's a meditation opportunity.
Yeah.
And I'm liking what's coming out of like those sessions where I'm giving myself.
All right. So you're going to be spending like an hour a day in the infrared, huh?
Well, if I love my 6 and 9 year old, but that is my one happy place where I have to myself. Very happy about that.
Totally. Totally.
All right. So radical transparency, is that like the decision tree at the company? Like if it's a radically transparent idea, we move forward. If not, we don't?
No, because there's so much about it's a filter. But another filter nowadays is all around the environment and how do we reduce carbon impact, right? So it's radical transparency was a communication lens. And what we realized is that's not actually a mission in of itself, because one could argue that Elon Musk is radically transparent at times. And I don't know that that's particularly effective for others. And so I view it and it leaves room for interpretation. So what we did over the past 2 years, is we actually recrafted our mission statement to help people live their best lives with the least impact on the planet. And that, helping people live their best lives, which we call look your best, do your best, feel your best. So that's if you're wearing the right things, you have confidence, all of that. And then if you take the other piece, it's the least impact. How do we continuously as a practice reduce our impact on the environment? And those two are really the lens countered with how do we continue to drive growth and profit in the business?
So obviously we're getting back to your new title, which is, think a year in.
It's like, just 9 months in. Yeah.
Okay. So you've birthed a new title. Congratulations.
Yep. And
so, I mean, we're back to that conviction story too. Like, did you always have the climate lead conviction story for you? It was just like, let me stay focused on the business until we're in a position where now I really, really can focus on this? Is that where you were?
No. Well, yes, yes. And I would say what I've always had is this how to do things in a simpler, better way. And in the early days, that was pricing transparency. Then it became factory transparency. And then as we scaled, it was, wow, the climate's an issue. This is a topic. And by the way, it's not a, once you finish it, you're done. It's an ongoing journey. And we really felt about 6 years in that we could hang our hat, 7 years in that we could hang our hat on that piece of it. We had evolved pricing transparency. Once you do it, you're kind of done. Factory transparency. There's more room to grow. You can create better working conditions, et cetera. And we continue to do that. But the climate's just such a core issue right now. And fashion, along with food and art and a few others, have an outsized voice relative to their actual impact. And so it felt like leveraging that position and motivating and inspiring change was critical for us. And that's what we decided to go after. And that's where I sort of transitioned out of the role of CEO and then also took on the work of climate lead.
I can't tell you, Michael, if I'm like glowing that a brand like yours is stepping up and taking on a problem like climate change, or like depressed and disappointed in our government, that it's going to take brands like Everlane to step up and own this, because government doesn't seem to be able to get out of their own way. Is this a good thing or a bad thing that brands are stepping up? And do you think more brands are doing it now than ever?
I think it's a great thing that brands are stepping up. I know that it's creating change, and where it's creating change at least is on the materials level. So a huge part of the issue is going to be around materials and energy. Energy, we can't control that much. There's a huge movement to try to get off oil, as everyone knows, but that's going to take some time. And that's so political, right? Germany just shut down nuclear. And then on the materials level, we're creating demand because fashion is fashion. So it loves to take on what's new. So when we say, okay, let's get rid of plastic, virgin plastic, all of a sudden, all the suppliers start coming up with new materials that will provide that. And there are 100 times more materials than there were 5 years ago in recycled polyester. And so that's really, really meaningful. Do I wish government was leading the way? Yes, because if they had said, we're going to actually give a discount on duties if you're recycled plastic, boy, would things have moved really fast across every company. Right now we have the good companies doing good things, but there are plenty of companies that just don't care. And that's a shame. And as a result, the consumer isn't always educated. And there's also a lot of issues around the word choices that people use and what people call greenwashing.
Yeah, I wonder what percent is fear-based. Like, people think their business is going to go under. They're just trying to survive. I'm not saying it's right. I think it's really hard to be president of a country that has 340 million people.
So hard.
Right. Especially now, like, good luck. And it's funny, I had this TV show idea that I'm not doing anything with called DSA. And it was like 10 years in the future, divided states of America. And at this point, we've all basically taken over a different state and the borders are basically shut off. Sort of a sad, it's kind of like Europe, frankly, but not Europe, but like of where everyone would go. Is this why government can't like move the needle fast enough?
I am going to say something that's a little bit more controversial than that. I think capitalism gets in the way. And in that sense, there are a lot of people, right? Because you tie things back. Why does a specific governor push a certain agenda around climate? Because companies based there or rich people in that state are saying, hey, that doesn't suit my interest as a capitalist. And so then they come back and push for certain things. And so I think the US economy is so structured around capitalism, similar to Britain, and similar to, largely as a post, I think it's always been that way, and then accelerated post neoliberalism, Margaret Thatcher and Reagan. And like, we're so rooted in capitalism that it just drives so many of our decisions. And a lot of that is good. We get insane innovation in the US. And I think a lot of that creates, divisiveness, or the fact that perhaps, 24% of U.S. adults are now on mental health prescription drugs in the U.S., which is wild. It was funny when I was young, I was like, oh, I'm going to change this. I'm going to show a new company. And it's just, that's very, very hard. You know, the U.S. is so rooted in this methodology, for good and for bad.
So speaking of change, it's been lots of changes at the company. You brought in, as you mentioned, a new CEO and Andrea O'Donnell. So how'd you guys meet? How did you meet? And then how's it going?
You know, when you talk about decisions, that decision took like a year and a half. That was a tough decision. And it's funny because now a lot of my friends and colleagues have made this decision. But I would say I was one of the earlier ones to make this move. And it definitely felt like a lonely journey because not a lot of people had done it. But I realized a few things. One, at the end of the day, I never wanted to be a public company CEO. I just don't want to do it. That's not the life I want to live. It's a lot, you know, being a president of 340 million is the hardest job. Being a CEO of a public company, unless you have a very specific temperament, very hard too. Being a CEO is very hard. And then I realized that for this next phase, bringing in somebody with just that had done it before was critical. And so I sort of wrote out a playbook of what was necessary for the next phase of Everlane and went out, met people, and met Andrea in Santa Barbara, where she was, because she had run UGG for 5 years. And we were just like, boom, click. It was so, you know, it was so awesome because that is so rare. And it's, you can click with someone, but then they also have the experience. It was just all of it done. And so I feel very, very fortunate for that. And we have a really, really good relationship. And I feel lucky. And I think part of it is also because I set out and said, what's the playbook that we need? And she met that. So she's not learning on the job in the same way that others might.
Was there any, like, did you know her from the business and you're like, I need to talk to Andrea or to
No, she keeps a low profile. I hadn't known her before. I got introduced to her and it was within a week. I was like, this is it. I know. And oftentimes these things take years to find the right person. So it was awesome.
So even though you have like three or four titles inside one, where does your energy now go? Like what are you most focused on?
Within Everlane, my energy focuses on, you know, a lot of, hey, where are we taking the brand? Keeping it. I know things need to change and I'm open to things changing, but then when they go a little bit too far, I'll pull back, right? And say, hey, I'm noticing this and this is not, you know, in the spirit of things. It's being a sounding board to Andrea. It's supporting the team. It's a totally different world. It's been actually really great because you don't get to, you know, there's no me telling people what to do. It's through influence and conversation. And then of course the climate side, and we are going to, you know, really lean into that even more, and working on some, new sort of external language. And we've done a lot of work with our director of sustainability, on how to make an impact there. And so continuing to push that agenda front and center and being a voice for her, because so often directors of sustainability come against the business, but because I care about that, I can just come in and say no, like, or, hey, we got to support Katina in this. And Andrew is really good about that too. So between the two of us, we really put that work front and center.
Andrea pretty much starts in the thick of the pandemic. That's never fun to start like right in the smack of it, but maybe, you know, look, the pandemic, this is such a tricky one. Cause you want to be mindful of everybody's had very different pandemics, but from a business standpoint, did it sort of, you know, we get robotic, and did it create like moments where you're like, oh, hey, this gives us an opportunity to reevaluate X, Y, or Z. What good came out of that sort of?
There were two. And it's funny. I remember when Andrew joined, I was like, oh, I'm kind of jealous because 2022 is going to be so easy compared to the past. And then we had more spikes. We had all the shipping issues, and then we had Ukraine war, and now of course Roe v. Wade. And so just like, and inflation. And so like all of this stuff just piled on, and I was like, oh, it's gotten harder. I think what the two big moments were, one, let's bring in a leader who can take this to the next level. That was a big rethinking moment. And the other one is let's really double, triple, quadruple down on this climate work. It's so critical. And I think even now I feel it's more critical than ever because it's not top of mind for a lot of people. People are focused on the inflation. People are focused on Ukraine war, as they should be. But hopefully companies like ours, where that's part of the mission, will continue to do that work so that when the pendulum swings back to thinking about climate, the work has been done and others can sort of capitalize on it.
Yeah, you said, you mentioned the mission earlier, help people live their best lives with the least impact on the planet. Can you kind of take us behind the curtain and share a little bit about how you're bringing this to life?
Yeah, it's, I think a lot about the why, like, why do we exist? Why are we here? And I think there's nothing wrong for us of saying we want to make really beautiful product, right? We want to make beautiful. Beauty is not something to shy away from. It's something for people to enjoy and be a part of. And so our goal on one end is to create beautiful product that people can enjoy day in and day out. And if we do that well, the feeling is you put on that t-shirt and you feel good about yourself. You look good. You feel like you're doing good because it's a better product. If you put on that shirt or those pants, it's like it gives you a little bit of boosted energy. Then okay, that's not just it. We're not just here to create beautiful product, because for us, the opportunity lives in, we have a voice. So what do we want to use that voice for? And for us, that voice is lowering the impact on the planet. And we use this framework, keep it clean, keep it cool, do right by people. Those are the most fundamental things we need to do. We need to keep the planet cool. That's the carbon side of it. We need to keep the planet clean. That's pollution. Those two are not necessarily related. It would be great if you do both, but there are two. You can produce a ton of plastic, which is better in some ways than, like polyester is better for the planet than leather. But there's pollution around that, and that affects people's lives and animals, all of this stuff. So keep it clean, keep it cool, and do right by people, which is the social governance side of what we do. So that's the way we approach this.
I feel like between radical transparency and help people live their best lives with the least impact on the planet, it must be pretty attractive to work at the company. Like how do those get used for hiring and maybe on moving on from certain people?
It's oftentimes the people that work at Everlane are our customers. You know, in some shape or form, they bought the product because they, you know, when you work at most companies, you don't actually have that kind of mission. So you don't get to feel that feeling every day of the impact you have. So I think there's two things. One is it attracts people. And then the other work to do is to make sure that people understand that the work they're doing each day is, as you recall, I sort of said, it's the practice of sustainability. So that practice is an everyday practice by selling things each day that are more sustainable than the last day, that have a lower impact or are cleaner. And that's the work we have to do. And so constantly even educating our own team around that is critical. And I would say we have always more opportunity there.
Is that a good, well, I think it's a good thing, but do you wake up energized or do you wake up like, oh my God, there's so much to do. This is like such a daunting task just to basically just save the planet, basically.
Well, I don't think we're saving the planet. I wake up calm about it now because to me, it's a practice. It goes back to that. It's just no single day on its own is that critical. And if we sell one thing that's not that, because we had to, that's not the most sustainable of the version that we could have made because it was that much more accessible to the consumer. We didn't have to charge $1,000 for it. So be it. And then the goal is over time to continue to do better. And I think is very calming and inspiring because if you consider it a practice, it's the journey over time. Everlane will produce way more product in the future than it ever has. So there's so much more opportunity to move things forward.
Is there like a single thing that keeps you up at night or that you're afraid of right now?
It's a very noisy world, noisier and noisier and noisier, and the pace of speed and the demand. I think what keeps me up at night is as much about our society as and then how it reflects to Everlane, which is this idea of the impatient human. There is no patience in this world right now. And I hope it changes, but that lack of patience creates a lack of dialogue. It creates an abundance of consumerism and it creates a life that I think is oftentimes for people can be stressful and can remove some of the quality of life. And I that's what keeps me up at night, and how to make sure that I don't fall into that. But then also, how do you, you know, create an environment or an idea that is slower and still can be very successful?
The impatient human is a, I don't know if it's a good t-shirt, but it's a truthful one. And so what creates the, what created the impatient human?
Oh my gosh. What do you think created it? I mean, I have my view.
I mean, I think the media is not helping. I think access to social media isn't helping. Yeah. I think you could rebrand the news, the bad news, frankly, at this point.
I think social media is probably the one for me. I think that one that you mentioned, because it's just, it accelerated the pace of access to information, and people are spending, you know, 5 hours a day. Kids are spending 5 hours a day. I almost feel like TikTok's a little bit better than Instagram, because at least it's entertainment. I don't know if you saw the folks internally at TikTok said, we're actually not a social platform, we're an entertainment platform.
Yeah.
And I'm like, thank you. I'd rather you be an entertainment platform, because then it's not this like, oh, he has this and she has that, and I gotta, and they have that, and I gotta have that too. You know, it's just, it's, I feel it's a little bit better around the anxiety than I sense Instagram can be.
I think so. Hartoon, who's a friend of mine, I've heard her say it, and I actually agree with you that it does feel like more entertainment than a social media platform. I also think every social media platform on the planet is going to tell you they're not a social media platform.
Fair enough. Right now, yeah, they're like, I don't want any government scrutiny, please. Right, we're an entertainment platform.
But you know, it's sort of sad. So I live in Southern California. My wife's strategy to manage anxiety is to not watch the news. Do I think that's a great strategy? But, I don't love it, but I understand it.
I think it's pretty good.
Right? Like,
I mean, like, you can't affect it anyways, you know? So like,
that's kind of where we are.
I was watching this old, you know, what was it? Selma Hayek, and like a story about Frida Kahlo and like the radicals and the communists and all this. And you see people conversing, and I yearn for more conversing and less watching in sort of disbelief as things happen. You know, it's the dialogue is something I yearn for.
So like, I always think if someone has made it 35, 40 minutes, they're invested in this conversation.
Yeah.
And I do think we want a better world. And I think we want to help. So how can we help? Like, in your mind, whether it's helping you or Everlane on their mission or cause, or just making mindful, or maybe even being a more patient human, where can we help?
It's what you just said is probably a great idea, right? Because if we were all a little bit more patient, and I didn't think about it that way, but if we were all more patient, we might buy a little bit less. We might listen a little bit more. We might think about, and do I, you know, eat a little bit healthier, or do I want this? You'll start to think about the decisions. You'll sit with your feelings and really start to enjoy versus the sort of numbing that's happening. So actually, I think that's if everybody was more patient and everybody listened more, but to be more tactical about it, because that's so hard, I would say, think about what you buy. You know, how does change happen? Change happens because their supply side change, which is something like Tesla, comes about and all of a sudden introduce a whole new idea that everybody copies. There's demand side change, which is consumers have a new trend that they bring on and want to push for it, and companies adjust their supply. And then there's government policy. And so in that world, the consumer has a lot of power. And if we can think about what that middle one is, the consumer demand side change, there's a lot of opportunity to demand more from companies and to actually put our money where our mouth is.
You reminded me of it's sort of funny, it sparked this. So I used to always say my mantra was patiently relentless.
That's cool. Yeah.
You know, it's like it's almost like slow cooked. What's the long view? Where are we going? There's still a sense of urgency.
The beautiful, yeah.
How do you get there? So where could you be more patient with the work you're doing right now?
I am really trying to spend time figuring out that next act, because I came out, you know, running, and then I realized that to make something, make a bigger difference both in my life and to leave something long lasting, that the patience was critical. So slowing down the decision-making process of what to do next.
Well, look, if it's hard to be you, you know, look,
it's not that hard. Well, it's probably harder to be you. You have kids. I don't have kids yet.
All right. Well, you know, in terms of, I was going to ask you the world that you want to create for them, if you so choose to go down that path. But I do think it's, look, you know, we always talk about a courageous, in some ways we get compensated to, you know, fight fear, build clarity, and create forums for hard conversations. And the hard conversation is when you're the guy, sometimes it's hard for people to just give you the, be radically transparent. So I'll do what many probably feel. And I want to thank you for giving a lot of your life to making the world a better place and making cool stuff. And if you do open up a restaurant, I am in. Let me know where it is. I already know the.
Where do you live in? Do you live in the east side or the west side?
No, I'm in San Diego. I'm in Encinitas, California.
Oh my gosh, you're living paradise. How long have you been living in Encinitas?
Well, I went from 2000. So I was New York City till 04. And then I moved to San Diego thinking I was going to write movies from the beach and take portfolio work up to LA. And then when you get to Encinitas, you're like, wait a minute, you can live here.
And oh yeah.
Rest is history.
You are a pioneer for Encinitas. So congratulations. I haven't been. I have so many friends that are OG from there and they love it. Love, love, love. And obviously now it's the hotspot.
Well, you know, it sounds like you have a lot of people to visit when you're down here, but add me to the list.
I'm adding you to the list. You might be first on the list now. This is a great conversation.
We'll do a real live lunch versus a fictitious digital lunch. Yeah. Michael, thanks so much for coming on. Keep doing what you're doing. And, you know, Key, again, I'm excited to see what the next decade looks like for you.
Likewise. Thank you, man. Appreciate it.